This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lee Chui Lin, as well as my fellow Christmas elf, Sharmila Ganesan. And today we have something a little bit different for you. It's actually an interview by former Malaysia-based anchor Jason Dacey, who now connects Australia and Malaysia through his company, Cockatoo Media. And he was kind enough to bring us this interview that he did with best-selling author Michael Robotham. I'll let him take it away.
This is Jason Dacey on the road, rediscovering my homeland of Australia, stories and interviews from the land down under. I'm with award-winning, best-selling, much-acclaimed author Michael Robotham, who's just released a new book. Good to see you again, Michael. It's been a while. We used to be colleagues, I should point out.
Yeah, it's been, we've got to count it up. It's been more than 30 years, Jason.
Yeah, it's, I think, at least 30, 35 years. We'll talk more about how we know each other a bit later on. And we'll also talk about how you had a quadruple heart bypass operation, and it's a miracle that here you are at the age of 58 that you're sitting in front of me, because you had a dice with death just maybe a year or so ago. We'll talk about that more, but tell me about your new book.
It's called Good Girl, Bad Girl. It's a psychological thriller. It's the start of a new series. I have created sort of two characters who I adore, one in particular, a very troubled teenage girl called Evie Cormack, who I think is probably the best character I've ever written. She was found hiding in a secret room where a man had been tortured to death 6 years ago, and refused to reveal her name when she was discovered. So nobody managed to identify her through all the DNA testing until sort of 6 years later. She's still in her children's home, and she's applying to be released. And a young psychologist called Cyrus Haven is sent in to interview her and to decide if Evie Cormack is ready for the world. But what he really has to decide is if the world is ready for Evie Cormack, because she's a remarkable young woman.
Well, your books are fantastic. I've read several of them. Your characters are very dark and there are many different twists and turns. But this is a bit of a departure, isn't it? It's something different to what you've been doing. Is it 14th book?
I was trying to think. I think it's the 13th, although someone said it was the 14th the other day, and I'm thinking I must be terrible at counting. I think I'm writing for too long when you lose count of... they're supposed to be like your babies, aren't they? You don't forget how many children you have, but it's either 13 or 14.
Yeah, and, tell us a bit more about Good Girl, Bad Girl, because it's getting a lot of attention media-wise, not just here in Australia, but also internationally, and we know that some of your books have been turned into movies and TV series. But what about, a little bit more about what we can expect, and, especially for our Southeast Asian listeners who want to go and buy one?
Yeah, this one it's quite a dark book, and I guess it's the mystery is, Evie Cormack, the reason I think she's remarkable is that she can tell when someone is lying. She's what's known as a truth wizard, and that's not something out of Harry Potter. They do exist. There are people in the world that can tell when someone is lying. Often they've come out of professions like the police force or the prison service or child services, where they're lied to every day, and they can start picking when people are lying to them. Evie Cormack has had such a violent, terrible, terrible childhood where she's had to pretty much to decide from one moment to the next whether someone was going to hit her or hug her. So she's developed this unique ability to tell when someone is lying. And when I say it's unique, it is a complete curse, because you have to just imagine for a moment, we lie all the time to each other to maintain relationships, to maintain friendships. We tell people that their new hair style is great and my bum doesn't look big. Your bum doesn't look big in that dress. We lie and say, I'm 5 minutes away, I only had one beer, I bought it on special. I mean, these are the simple little lies we tell. But what a curse it would be if we knew every time someone was lying to us.
I'm with award-winning, best-selling author Michael Robotham in Brisbane, where he's on a book tour across Australia. And, of course, his book Good Girl, Bad Girl is coming out, and people can buy that. But let's go back to the beginning, Michael, because you and I worked together many, many years ago in a news organisation, John Fairfax and Sons. Sounds very old-fashioned now, doesn't it? And you were, you're around a year older than me. You were a year ahead of me. You were a journalist on the Sydney Sun. Did you ever imagine, when we were both young cadet journalists, as they were called in Australia then, did you ever imagine that you'd be a best-selling author?
No, it's funny. I mean, I wanted to be a writer from a really young age. I mean, I grew up in very small country towns in Australia. And I wanted to be a writer from about the age of 11 when I read the works of Ray Bradbury, you know, a very famous writer who wrote Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, we studied at school, didn't we?
Exactly. And I wrote a letter to him when I was 11 years old. And I don't recall putting a stamp on the envelope, but I put it in a postbox in my little country town. And 3 months later, I came home from school to find a package containing the three books that weren't available in Australia and a letter from Bradbury himself saying how thrilled he was to have a young reader on the far side of the world. And I sort of feel as though I became a journalist to gather material, because I grew up in very small country towns and I feel as though Mark Twain had written all the best plots, you know, and I had nothing to write about. And so I became a journalist and, you know, like you, we became cadets. It was very hard to become a cadet journalist. Mm. Ever since Woodward and Bernstein had broken Watergate, every man and his dog wanted to be a journalist. And you and I, yeah, we were one of the last people to go into journalism straight out of school, straight out of high school.
And here we are in our late 50s. It's hard to believe, you know, 35 years have passed since we were last sitting face-to-face here. But something very dramatic happened to you last year, I believe. And, you know, I'm looking at you, you look fit, you look healthy, you know, not carrying any excess weight. But you were on the brink of dying and you had a quadruple bypass heart operation. I know a lot of people listening out there probably think, you know, this would never happen to me, but you could really not be alive now. You were very, very close to dying.
Yeah, and it came as a complete shock because I had no symptoms whatsoever. Unbeknown to me, it's in my family. I mean, I had no idea it was in my family. That genetically, I was predisposed to having a heart condition. But, you know, I have a resting heart rate of 48. I exercise, I eat a good diet, I'm not overweight. And I didn't have a single symptom, but I had a GP who just said, oh, go and do this test. And it was like an exercise ECG on a treadmill. That was inconclusive, but they decided just to do one more test. And they discovered that I had one artery 100% blocked and one 98% blocked and one 46% blocked. And they wouldn't let me get off the table because they thought, we can't work out why you're still here because the left-hand side of your heart is getting 2% blood flow. And it wasn't until the surgeon arrived that she said that she told me that my one good working artery was forcing blood under my heart to keep me alive. So my heart had changed itself to keep me alive. You know, and so I could have dropped and I wouldn't have survived the heart attack. I would have just dropped and died on the spot. So very fortunate.
With acclaimed author Michael Robotham just releasing Good Girl, Bad Girl. It's his 14th novel, we think. Could be 13th, but he's written a lot and he's much acclaimed. So how did that change your perspective on things? Because, you know, you're a proud dad. You know, one of your daughters is very successful as a music producer and writer. I mean, you've had so much success, but how does it change your perspective?
It's interesting. Initially, you know, people said, oh, you must have felt like a new man. And because I physically didn't have any symptoms, I didn't feel any different. But it gave me this massive sort of shock, I suppose, is that I brush with, you know, mortality where, you know, you suddenly decide I'm not going to put things off, you know. I mean, that trip to Africa, like I took a trip to Africa, you know, went back there this year. And, you know, that desire to just sort of see as much of my children and see as much of the world. And, you know, I'm not going to stop writing books because it's what I love, you know, love doing. But I think I'm going to try to embrace life and just sort of look at the colours and just stop. You know, I saw a beautiful, beautiful sunrise this morning from up in Mullaney, up in the mountains, you know, northwest of Brisbane. And it was just, I just sat there in awe of this amazing sunrise and thought, I've got to do this more often.
This is By the Book, and today we're bringing you an interview between former Malaysia-based anchor Jason Dacey and Michael Robotham. We'll be back with the rest of the conversation right after this. Keep it here on By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Bigotry-free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
Hello, this is By the Book with Sharmila and Lynn. Today we're airing an interview that was kindly brought to us by Jason Dacey, former Malaysia-based anchor who spoke to Michael Robotham, best-selling author.
So earlier Jason and Michael were discussing a brush with death. So here's where they pick it up.
Let's talk more about, you know, your journey into becoming an author. And, you know, the two of us were young cadet journalists. We were in a hurry. We were brash. We thought we knew everything. We were teenagers and, you know, we're working in Sydney. And both of us made journeys to London, you know, at a fairly young age, in our early 20s, early to mid-20s. And, you know, you went to Fleet Street and then you had success working for some of the big papers of Britain. But what intrigued me was you became a ghostwriter for famous people, including Ginger Spice, Jerry Halliwell, right? Mm. What was that like?
Yeah, it's interesting, I suppose, having never lost that desire to be a novelist, and yet, you know, I'm sure you know, we were both seduced by journalism. Mm. I mean, it's an amazing profession, and you can travel the world and report on sort of, you know, historic events, you know, life-changing events. But I never, ever lost the desire to be, you know, a novelist. And but I then began to wonder if I had the patience or the discipline, because as a journalist, you're always writing your 800 words or 1,000 words or doing, you know, a small segment, you know, to camera. And so I thought ghostwriting might teach me if I have that discipline. And I met a ghostwriter when I was working on Fleet Street. I didn't know they existed. I didn't know that famous people had sort of ghostwriters. And so I thought, okay, this is the next step. Let's see if I have the discipline. So, you know, as I said, Jerry Halliwell of the Spice Girls, Lulu, the 60s pop star, mm-hmm. you know, To Sir With mm-hmm. Love, you know, Dennis Thatcher, you know. I mean, there were some remarkable people that I wrote for in the end. But I think the magic of ghostwriting and what it taught me was a ghostwriter has to these are their books, these are their autobiographies. So I had to capture their voice so perfectly that people that had known them their entire lives would not recognize my fingerprints on that story. So it was that ultimate job. It's almost like being a portrait painter, and you start, but you have to use their brushstrokes and paint them with their skills.
It's a different art, isn't it? And I mean, like you, I think I'm very nosy. I love hearing people's stories, and I want to know what makes them tick, and I want to know every detail and every date. I think it's just part of, you know, who we are as journalists. But you'd already written a novel, in a great Australian novel, as they say, that never was accepted. But then I think around 2002 or so, you kind of went into the crime writing genre, which is my favorite genre. I love reading that kind of stuff, including your books. So how did you make that leap, you know, from being a ghostwriter to being a successful crime novelist?
I was in between projects. I just finished a ghostwritten book, and I'd been told in 3 months' time, actually, it was the book Lulu, the autobiography of Lulu, was coming up, and I was asked if I'd do that. And I had this window of 3 months, and I wrote 117 pages of a novel, which I had no idea was a crime novel. And it triggered a bidding war at the London Book Fair in 2002. And by then I was back. I'd moved back from London to live in Australia. I was living in Sydney, and the phone was ringing at 3 o'clock in the morning from my UK agent, saying that there were 5 American publishers bidding and 4 German publishers bidding, and the French had offered this and the Italians offered this. And in the space of 3 hours, it was translated into more than 20 languages, and I think it's now into sort of 27, including quite a number of Asian languages. I mean, every dream I'd ever had came true in that sort of 3 hour period. You don't go to sleep after something like that. And by 7:30 in the morning, my wife and I were still awake looking at the ceiling, by which time we'd spent the money, you know, and by 8 o'clock we'd cast the Hollywood film. And by 8:30, the terror set in, thinking, oh my God, these people think I can write a novel and I don't know how it ends. But I mean, it was the most astonishing way to start my career.
It really was, you know. And I remember, you know, I was in the US, I think, not long after that, and I was working over there. I remember walking into a bookstore in New York City, and I'm seeing, like, Michael Rowbotham displayed there as a novel, and I'm like, is that the same guy? So I kind of did a double take, and I looked it up. And, of course, you lose contact. You know, we were colleagues, you know, 30 years and plus ago, and here you are, you know, being brandished in a New York City, Manhattan bookstore. But what intrigues me, too, is how German readers and TV viewers have really taken to your work. They love it, and you've got the TV series and films from that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Germans, I can never quite understand why, but of all the markets in the world, Germany has been phenomenal. It's the only place, I mean, I go to where I get an inkling of what it's like to be a rock star. I mean, I'm due to go to Germany in October, and there'll be people waiting at my hotel when I get there. And normally when I do an event in Germany, 700 people will show up. And they've made, I think the sixth film is just about to be shown on German TV. I've just had a book called The Secrets She Keeps. They've just wrapped up filming a six-part TV series, which is actually set in Australia. They've moved the action from London to Sydney. And I guess the other major sort of film news is that I've just signed a deal, a company called World Productions, who made a wonderful BBC series called The Bodyguard and Line of Duty, mm-hmm. have just bought the rights to my Joe O'Loughlin series. So
I've seen The Bodyguard on Netflix.
It's a terrific drama. And Line of Duty is I think it's in its fourth series now. They're terrific, terrific dramas. And so, I mean, you never hold your breath with these things. I mean, a few have actually been made. I know when my first ghostwritten book was a book called Empty Cradles, the story of Margaret Humphreys, a social worker from England who uncovered the child migrant scandal where 150,000 British children were cleared out of children's homes and sent all around the world from about 1850 to 1968. That took 19 years to be made into a film called Oranges and Sunshine. So, wow. You know, it was optioned the moment I wrote it in about 1997, and it took 19 years to make it to the screen.
Well, I've seen on social media, you know, Stephen King, you know, giving you glowing praise for your latest book. And one of my heroes of crime writing is Michael Connelly, who you're friends with and hang out with. So we're all envious, but, you know, your talent and skill has taken you a long way. But I guess what I'd want to know is, you know, what's going to be the next thing? For you know what are you just going to keep going as you are, or especially knowing what you've gone through with your health scare?
It's an interesting one. I think, you know, I would like to do, I've for the first time I have been involved in the TV drama that just finished filming. Maybe I'll get a little bit more involved in that side of things, but you know, I think I've been writing a book a year pretty much for the last 14 years, and I think at some point I'd like to sort of pull back and maybe do a book every 2 years. But one of the things it's taught me, this being involved in film, is I love being a writer because, you know, as a crime writer, I'm this godlike figure where I decide what happens. And once you start working in film and TV, you've got networks and producers and directors and actors and foreign distributors, and they're all trying to tell you what they think they should do. And I like the fact that I'm in control.
So when might we see you in Southeast Asia? Because you have a lot of fans in Singapore and Malaysia, and you travel so much.
I'd love to. A couple of times I've been invited to writers' festivals there, and I haven't. It's always corresponded with when I'm already on tour somewhere else. But I'm looking forward to getting up there to some of those sort of Southeast Asian festivals, because it's a part of the world that I love, you know, and I love traveling there. But I've never actually gone up there with my writer's hat on.
Michael, what a treat it is to see you again after 35 years, and to know that you survived your health scare and the way that, you know, our lives have turned out from being those young, brash with reporters with the bad hairstyles and the bad fat ties. Huh?
And we haven't changed a bit, have we?
not a bit. This has been Jason Dacey on the road in Brisbane, Australia. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So that was a chat between Jason Dacey and Michael Robotham. Let us know what you think. Do you read Michael's books? Are you a fan of the psychological thriller genre? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. That brings us to footnotes, and I hope you didn't think that we were ever going to let you kind of listen to us so close to Christmas and have us not talk about Christmas. You know, that's just crazy.
Yes, because how can we not talk about books when it comes to Christmas? It's one of those definitive genres, isn't it? Novels and fiction that revolve around the idea of Christmas time and presents and family, but also some pretty depressing stories.
I think because it's a very rich
thread to mine, right? Christmas brings about so many different things. There's the pure commercialism of the shopping, but there's also the family stuff and how complicated that can get. There is also the religious stuff. There is also just the fact that it's a time of year, I think, the reason why it's so ripe for storytelling is because it's a time of year where expectations are sky high. Yes. Everybody thinks that there's going to be snow and gifts and, you know, hugs and whatever. And more often than not, you're just by yourself. And or at least that is kind of the moral or the beginning, the starting point of these stories.
I think as a counterpoint of, you do talk about this at Christmas, the people who have and the people who don't have. Mm. And don't have can manifest in many ways. You don't, you know, very literally, you don't have the means to have a Christmas. Or you don't have family, you don't have company. So I know this is starting to sound very depressing for a Christmas episode.
But just what we observe about Christmas fiction, right? I think broadly speaking, it falls into the categories of the books that are basically Love Actually, where, you know, it's a heartwarming tale. Yes. And there's usually some romantic element because, again, Christmas, like prom, is just that period of time where people are coming together and expectations are high. But on the other side of that are the not necessarily tales with a moral, but I think tales with an ethical heart, right? Yeah. Like where they want you to think about other people during this period where you are supposed to.
Well, how can we not now go to Christmas Carol, right?
Yes. So that is obviously, I guess, the classic text.
I think the first book that always comes to mind for most people when you say Christmas book is usually Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. And, you know, it's been made into plays and into movies. And it is that story of someone learning to think beyond themselves during this time of year. And I suppose it encapsulates what the spirit of the celebration is about.
Yes. And the importance of not being a Scrooge, you know, like the true essence of it all. And I think it's been adapted so much, partly because it has, I think, a lot of different elements. During Christmas, I think it's a time of year to look back at the year that's gone. Mm-hmm. It's also a time where you're supposed to be reflective about whether or not you deserve a gift or a lump of coal. And I think because of that, this idea of having ghosts literally coming to you is very appealing. And also, it has a heartwarming ending. So despite the fact that there are real moments of pain and worry within it, it comes good in the end.
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them, for his own heart laughed, and that was good enough for him. He had no further intercourse with spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence principle ever afterwards. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well. May that be truly said of us and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
I was thinking again of what I liked, and the one that came to mind was The Little Matchstick Girl, and that is a story, of course, by Hans Christian Andersen.
Once upon a time, in the bitter cold of the last night of the year, a wee girl walked through the darkening streets. She was all alone. Snow whirled all about, falling on her bare head, chilling her beneath her thin, ragged clothes. The girl had worn her mother's shoes when she had left the house.
And it always really appealed to me as a kid. Something about the imagery of the girl, about that warmth of the matches as she lit them. And also, I suppose, ultimately of wishes, right? Of this being a time of year where you wish upon things and you hope for things.
Well, you know, on this strain of you and me constantly accidentally picking the same things.
We swear it is accidental.
Because we didn't discuss this before. No. But the first story that came to mind when I thought about Christmas on the page was Hans Christian Andersen, but mine was The Tin Soldier.
The soldiers belonged to a small boy He had dozens of toys, from balls and clowns to a magnificent model castle. The castle had high walls and turrets and windows to peep inside. White wax swans swam outside on a lake of mirror surrounded by miniature trees. But most beautiful of all was the tiny dancer who stood at the castle door. She wore a necklace hung with a glittering sequin. Because she stood in pirouette on one foot, the tin soldier thought she must just have one leg like him.
Oh, I love that story.
You know, and I remember being so, so sad about the story. I mean, no spoilers, but it ultimately ends with the paper ballerina that he's in love with and him being burnt at the fireplace.
I was going to say, it ends in a fire.
And I also never realized that it wasn't originally a Christmas story because it's become so associated with Christmas. Actually, he gets the soldier on his birthday, not for Christmas. But the subsequent iterations of these toys have turned them into a Christmas story.
Mm.
And I always think of it as a Christmas story, especially, I guess, with the idea of the fire and the idea of being lost and being found and finding someone to spend your days with. It's very Christmassy.
It is. I think the pure visuals of the story also, because, of course, we know about Nutcracker, Little Drummer Boy, and I think the Little Tin Soldier fits within that mold of, you know, like what you associate with Christmas. I will also say that this story really traumatized me over paper boats. Like, of all the things, it wasn't fire that scared me. But whenever I saw paper boats, I was like, what's on it? What's on it floating away, you know, in an uncontrollable manner?
Yep.
And maybe we should make it a thing to try and look for stories that are less traumatizing for Christmas. I mean, these are what have worked for us.
Yeah. Well, but I was going to say, though, that because I don't come from a family that actually celebrates Christmas
in its truest religious form.
Right. Mm. And also because Christmas here in Malaysia is very different from Christmas in all of these books that we tend to read. What's interesting is I do think that the idea of Christmas was transmitted to me predominantly through books and movies.
For me, it's through songs, but I get where you're coming from, because I think if you don't grow up in a household where you know, where the Bible is sort of a founding text and where Christmas stems from that, then all you get is what gets translated to you from the world, right? And I think one thing that we did want to talk about in line with that, in line with the movies, the books, the whatever, is, of course, The Grinch.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Oh, The Grinch is the definitive Christmas book for me. I feel like I came to Dr. Seuss later, not as a child, but this idea of what the word The Grinch is, you know, it's in common parlance. Like we use it in reference to the spoiler. And I just think that it's such a clever spin on the idea of Christmas. This, again, the Scrooge. But then you also realize the reason that he hates Christmas is because he was made to feel bad. And that's kind of sweet.
I think really the beating heart of most of these Christmas stories or stories that come to be associated with Christmas is empathy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and we talk about this a lot throughout the show, the idea that fiction and reading in general builds empathy. But because I think Christmas, whether or not you are a believer, whether or not you are even a participant, it's a time of year where I think we're all just a bit more vulnerable because we've been primed to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
We're susceptible to emotions this time of year. And I think for that reason, these stories really have us thinking about the other, have us thinking about other people. And yeah, like
We started off saying it was depressing, but maybe it's a good thing.
No, I definitely think it's a good thing. And I also think that Christmas, or rather a book, doesn't have to be only about Christmas for me to remember Christmas scenes from them. And I'm just thinking of books like Little Women, which we've talked about before, and how that definitive scene of the four girls and Marmee waiting for the father to come home for Christmas and that not happening, and then them creating their own sort of ritual and gift-giving and that family togetherness. That scene for me is really warm, and really it's one of the earliest memories I have of a novel sort of having this pivotal, if I'm not mistaken, it's how the book starts.
Yeah.
It starts with Christmas and father not coming home. And there's always that idea, isn't it? And even with Anne of Green Gables, there's always what happens at Christmas time. There's this excitement around it. I feel like it's that pivotal moment in many people's stories that depict what they have, what they hope to have, and who they are as people.
So what are your favorite Christmas stories or Christmas books? What are the books that you crack out this time of year? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. All that remains is for us to wish everyone celebrating and just everyone in general a very Merry Christmas. We will see you back here next week. This is By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.